Okay, thank you, Philippe, for the invitation and for the introduction. So this is joint work with Amelia Durbeck, who was a PhD student with me, and Matt Wilson, who is a PhD student at University of Oxford. I'd like just to say a little thing about the situation of the group there at University Paris-Saclay. We are a very new group, quantum computation structures, it's called QUARKS, in a computer laboratory, the Laboratoire de Méthodes Formelles. But we are growing fast and we've already got five permanent members. We are actually recruiting a junior professor this year. So there are quite a few opportunities in France nowadays. Let's hope it continues. So I want to motivate the topic of today with some considerations about tensor products, some pedestrian considerations about your good old tensor product. And so I want to take this little picture where we've got three systems, and these three systems are called U, V, W. They could be, Alice, Bob, Charlie. And one thing we can do is to say that, well, there is the U system on the left of a tensor product, and on the right, there are the V and the W system. We could rewrite this as these two tensor factors. But we could equally well decide that this factorizes as UV on the left and W on the right. So this is equal to that is equal to that. Then when I look at these two, I'm finding that this symbol here, the tensor product, doesn't have the same meaning here and there. It's doing something different. And so if I wanted to be a bit pedantic and I wanted to make the notation more precise, perhaps I should actually say that this is a tensor product that serves to isolate the U system, and this is a tensor product that serves to isolate the U and V systems on the left. If I start doing this, okay, why not? But then one may wonder what kinds of discriminating functions, chi's are we really allowed? I mean, how far can we go at this game? For instance, could it be the case that I could split this state not according to the names of the systems, U, V, W, but rather according to the internal states of these systems, this field that is living on the system? Perhaps I could say, well, actually, I want to re-express my state with the white nodes on the left and the black nodes on the right. And then, for instance, this quantum superposition here would be expressed as this superposition over here. And you see that could be interesting because this discriminating criterion of being white and black is something that is possibly quantum, possibly in a superposition. This entails that the split that I'm doing with my mu parameterized tensor is also in a superposition. Here I have a superposition of having one system on the left and two systems on the left. Also, it lets you express things that perhaps we knew, but now we have a notation to say this efficiently. So for instance, here is a state where, okay, we have U and V that are in definite states, white and black here, but W is in a superposition state of being white and black. And this state, I could just re-express according to the mu tensor as this superposition. And so what I realize is that when I do the split according to this chi UV, I've got a product state. there is no entanglement. But when I do the split according to mu, then there is entanglement between the left and the right. So entanglement is relative to the choice of this tensor split. Okay. So the plan of the talk here is to actually define properly this sort of generalized tensor that I've just motivated in a hand-wavy manner at the minute. I want to, you know, explain what the Hilbert space is, explain, you know, give just the rigorous definitions, a few properties. Then I want to explain why they work, why they do the job as tensors and traces. And finally, I want to explain what the possible applications of these things are, because in fact, I personally was never interested in generalizing tensors and traces. My aim was always to study dynamics, you know, quantum evolutions over networks that drive graphs into superpositions of graphs. And it's only as I was approaching this problem that I found myself obliged to look at these generalizations of tensors and traces. Okay. So now I want to be a bit more precise about, first of all, the Hilbert space in which things live in this talk. So first of all, there is this completely classical notion of a system. What I mean by a system is just a single node that has some unique name, U. So U is an element in some big set V that has to be infinite because you want unique names. So you're going to have enough names so that the names are unique. And each node may have an internal state. For instance, it may be black or white. So some state in sigma, which is often taken to be a finite set, doesn't really have to be finite. Okay. Then what I mean by a graph is just a finite set of systems, a finite set of nodes, of colored nodes, each of them having unique names. So why do I call them graphs if there are no edges? Well, there will be edges and towards the end of the talk, I will explain how to introduce them. But right now, they will only make things complicated. And so it's not the moment to introduce them. Let's just say, okay, these graphs are basically sets, finite sets of systems. And so the set of the possible graphs is called curly G. What is the Hilbert space then? The Hilbert space is basically that one Hilbert space whose canonical orthonormal basis is but the set of graphs. That is, a valid psi in my Hilbert space is anything that looks like a superposition of graphs. Okay? Right. So now I was starting to envision this thing about parametrizing the tensor product according to some discriminating function chi, right? So what sort of functions are allowed? And it turns out that you cannot do anything, but you can do many things. And the things you can do, we call them restrictions. So the way we parametrize these tensors is by providing a restriction. A restriction is a function from graphs, so a classical thing, to graphs. And basically, it takes a graph and it says, oh, I'm just going to keep this part here, g chi. Of course, this g chi must be a subset of the whole graph. So for instance, this node u here is a subset of this whole graph. Okay. And there is a small requirement that arised from the necessity of the mathematics, if you want to make things work, which is that for any two graphs, G and H, if it so happens that H is comprised between the restriction of G under chi and G, then we demand that the restriction of H under chi coincides with the restriction of G under chi. Okay. It's not a crazy thing to ask for. And in particular, the restrictions that I've already introduced in the motivation part of the talk do obey this this condition. So, for instance, earlier on, I was using chi-u, and chi-u, what it does is it just selects system U. I was using mu, and mu, what it does is it selects the systems that are white. Okay. So, a few remarks. This condition here entails idempotency. So if I restrict and then I further restrict, well, it's no use. I mean, you've already restricted once. It's a projection. You're projecting on a subpart of the graph in that sense. If I restrict and then I try and look at the complements, well, there is nothing. It's this condition here. What I mean by chi bar is basically the rest, you know, what's left out of the graph when I take out G chi. And okay, the point is, if chi and zeta are restrictions, so is chi union zeta. It's, you know, the restriction that is defined that way. And also, when we will be in the world of graphs, if chi is a restriction, then so is chi r. That is, the chi r is chi plus the r neighbors in the graph of chi. Okay, so my point is, there's many things that fall into this definition of a restriction. Now, restrictions, they serve this role of parametrizing these generalized tensors. So now let me actually define the generalized tensors. So first of all, those are things that take superpositions of graphs, and give you back a superposition of graph. It serves to split the Hilbert space into two, but it's still acting upon the same Hilbert space. I mean, traditionally, when you have a tensor product, you say, okay, I'm going to take Hilbert space A, I'm going to take Hilbert space B, and I'm going to go create Hilbert space AB, right? But here it's not the case. Here this tensor product is internalized. It's a binary operation of that same Hilbert space. So we just, okay, it's a bilinear operator. Why? You just demand that it be bilinear. It's part of the definition. And once you've demanded that it's bilinear, it suffices that you define it on basis state. And those basis states, there are graphs. So I take a graph L and a graph R, and I want to define the tensor product of the two. And so we say, well, if the left-hand side and the right-hand side, they are parts of a larger graph, G, in such a way that actually the left-hand side is the chi restriction of this larger graph, and the right-hand side is what's left over, then I give you back this larger graph. And if it's not the case, I give you back the null vector. So that was a bit of a leap we took at some point to suddenly decide that the tensor product, when it's, you know, when it's shouldn't be defined should give you back the null vector. But it turns out that it works very well in the mathematics. And so, for instance, here I've got node V, KU, node U. Well, that doesn't work because KU is meant to select the U systems and have them on the left, not the V systems. So that should give you back the null vector. Here, I have node U tensored with node U. Well, that doesn't work either because KU wouldn't leave behind a node called U. Okay. So that's the definition. And you can then use this definition to define the tensor product of operators just in the usual way that you use to lift the definition of tensor products over tensors up to tensor products over operators. That grayish part, I will just skip over and come back if there are questions that are directing me towards that. Right. So you can define a tensor product parameterized on these restrictions, and you can also define a trace parameterized on this restriction. So you can say, okay, here is a density operator over this Hilbert space of superpositions of graphs, but I'm interested in keeping the chi part. Okay. So how do you define that? Well, you say, first of all, I want the trace to be linear. Once you've said that, it only remains to define the trace over basis states, so some brackets like that. And here you say, well, a trace out. So by the way, this is the trace out that keeps chi and gets rid of chi bar, right? I mean, this is my notation for I keep chi. So therefore, I should keep the restriction of G to chi, the restriction of H to chi. And as for the rest, I need to compare them. I need to see if they're equal because after all, you know, I need to do the trace on chi bar. And the trace is, comparing, you know, taking the diagonal elements. So therefore, making sure that they are equal. So it defines the trace. And let me just give you some examples of that. So for instance, in this KG bra H, the complement of KU is this black node V. And it's the same for G and H. So this is going to be worth one. And what will be left here is this and that. So KU bra U. Here, it's a typo. This is a U. Okay. Now, let me look at this example here. I'm going to look at the complement of KU. So here is this black node. Here is this white node. So this is going to go to zero. This whole thing is null. Okay. Here, the whole thing is null for a different reason. Because if I look at the complement of KU, it's a graph and nothing, the empty graph. So those are different. So I give you back null. So, okay, you may think, yeah, why not? But perhaps this definition is a bit crazy. I mean, it's not. It turns out that, for instance, it is a trace-preserving completely positive map over the Hilbert space of graphs. So, therefore, it's a perfectly reasonable quantum operation to do on these density matrices. Moreover, if you have some restriction zeta that is smaller, that is comprehended within another restriction chi, and that you need to define this correctly, but you have what you expect, which is that if you restrict under chi and then under zeta, well, because zeta is smaller than chi, it's the same as just restricting under zeta. Okay, and you have plenty of small properties like that reassure you about the fact that this is indeed a partial trace. Okay. So I give you a pretty, enough elements to make these definitions of generalized tensors and traces precise. But this could all be a crazy mathematical game. I mean, I'm introducing some new symbols, playing around with them, looking at a few properties, but do they really deserve to be called tensors and traces? Well, so then I have to ask you this question. I mean, why do we use tensors and traces for in quantum mechanics to begin with? I mean, what's the point about the tensor product? What's the point about the partial trace? If someone has a different answer, please say it. But my understanding is that we use tensors and traces to speak about systems, about places, So you have your Hilbert space, and at some point you want to say, well, but my Hilbert space, there is the left hand side and the right hand side. Those are two places, and maybe I will do a local operation on the left, and maybe there will be signaling from the left to the right, etc. I mean, the point is that tensors and traces, what they are used for is basically to build notions of locality and causality in quantum mechanics. Locality. Okay, so what do we mean by locality? So first of all, here is a rather intuitive picture of what we mean by A is a chi local operator. A is a chi local operator means A is only changing what's at chi. So if I do a local operation on my desktop here, well, it means I'm just changing what's on my desktop. Okay. So a local operator, yes, what it does basically is that the rest of the graph, g chi bar, is going to be left unchanged, but the g chi part, it may evolve. Okay. That's intuitively what we mean by local. Now, we have to give a definition of that, and here is a Schrödinger picture definition of this in terms of transition amplitudes. If A is local, what I mean is that the transition amplitude from G to H under the action of A, well, first of all, this whole thing is going to be zero if G chi and H chi do not coincide over the complement of chi. And second of all, this transition amplitude, it should only depend on what's at G chi and what might be at H chi. So it should be something of that form. So here is a Schrödinger picture way of phrasing what it means to be local on chi. Here is a more operational way of phrasing what it means to be local on chi. That's telling the story that, okay, I'm going to perform something, and this something is I do something at chi, and over the rest, I do nothing. I do the identity. Okay. And here is a Heisenberg picture way of thinking about locality. So in this Heisenberg picture way, A is not to be thought as an evolution, but rather it is to be thought as an observable, or maybe as an element of a POVM. And you may be interested in knowing the probability that this the outcome corresponding to this element comes out. And you have this expression that this probability is a trace A rho. But if A is local, it means you're measuring something very local. And so you don't need to know the whole universe to know the outcome of this measurement you are doing on your desktop. And so you're only interested really in the state of your desktop, which is the reduced density matrix according to chi, your desktop. And so it should be the case that this probability is equal to that one. Okay. So when I mean that these tensors and traces work, I mean that all of these facts that we like and are used to about locality, and that that makes that help us, you know, make sense of this notion of a place in which I'm going to act and leave the rest unchanged in quantum mechanics, all of these notions, they still work under these generalized tensors and traces, and they are still equivalent. They are still fully equivalent. You get this theorem. Okay. Maybe I should have started by an example, actually. Here is an example of a local operation on V. So I have a line of spins, and now I take this spin and I apply some U2 over there so that I put the spin that's at V in a superposition of being up and down, for instance. Mm. Yeah, okay, that, that could be an example. Okay, so locality. Now, the other another very important notion is causality. Causality, I want to distinguish it, but perhaps the best way to do so is through a smallish example. So again, here is a line of particles. And in one time step, you know, we evolve this thing in discrete time steps. Yeah, I'm talking about discrete time here, by the way. So if I evolve this in the discrete time step, then my particles will move. For instance, this particle is a left mover, and it's going to be found here. And this particle is a left mover as well, but there is nothing left, so maybe it's going to bounce, and it's going to become a right mover. The point is, this M evolution here, you see, it's evolving everybody at the same time. It's not at all local. We cannot say that M is local. M is not local. M is changing everyone at the same time. You know, it's like, you know, the laws of physics, they are not local. There is stuff happening everywhere at once. Okay. Nevertheless, information propagates at a bounded speed, right? And this is what we mean by causal. What, you know, the state of this node here at time t plus one is a function of the neighboring states at time t. So even though everything gets updated at once and rho becomes a rho prime, there is still this mathematical condition that tells you that whatever is observable there at time t plus one is a function of what was observable somewhere larger at time t. Okay, and that's what I mean by that's what I mean by zeta chi causality. Did I write? Oh. Actually, I made a mistake in my. Yeah. So okay, this is what I mean by U, this operator, being chi zeta causal. What I mean by what this is saying is, The stuff at zeta is provoked, it's caused, and it's fully determined by the stuff at chi. For instance, the stuff at V is fully determined by the neighbors of V. Okay. So that's the intuitive picture of what it means to be causal. But then you could formalize this mathematically. And again, there is the Schrödinger way of formalizing this. It's there. And it's very clear what it says. It says, let's take rho. Let's evolve it into rho prime. Let's focus on rho prime zeta. Well, really, this only depends on that. So I could get the same results by taking rho restricted to chi, evolving that instead, and then focusing upon zeta. Okay, so that's Schrödinger picture of causality. The operational picture of causality is the idea that, but these causal evolutions, they don't come out of nowhere. They come out of lots of smallish interactions, lots of local operations. And so it's the idea that U is in fact a big circuit of local guys. And then there is the Heisenberg picture of causality. The Heisenberg picture of causality is this idea that if you have an observable at time t plus one, well, it should correspond to something which at time t was already observable in the neighborhood, right? So an observable that is local at time t plus one is still local at time t, if I bring it back to time t. Okay. So, I mean, those are different ways to talk about causality that are used in different communities. But again, what I want to emphasize is that all of these things remain true for the generalized tensors and traces. So the point is they work at the mathematical level. They serve very well the purpose of talking about places, locality, and how these places interact and signal to one another. So, all right, but why would that be useful at all? So, nowadays, a number of people are interested in this topic of quantum reference frames. Quantum reference frames, one of the ideas of quantum reference frames is, for instance, to be able to take a view upon the world from the standpoint of an observer, but this observer is also a quantum system. Okay, you also get these kinds of ideas in the Wigner's friend sort of thought experiments. So, for instance, here, there is a white particle, there is a black particle, and the white particle is in a superposition of being in position zero and being in position one. Nevertheless, the white particle, maybe she's called Alice and she has her point of view upon the world. And we may be interested to take that reference frame, to take that point of view. So here, what we have is kind of similar, doesn't quite do the same job, but the point is, I already introduced this mu tensor, the one that singles out white nodes. Well, if I apply it here to decompose these two states, what I get is that I'm basically selecting Alice. And what remains is her viewpoint of the world. So now I'm looking from the perspective of Alice. I could, in fact, trace out Alice if I wanted to then see what is the reduced density matrix of the rest of the world. But here, I haven't traced out. What I see is just that Alice, in a way, she sees Bob, the black particle, to be in a superposition. Now, in quantum reference frames, you would actually realign these numbers to make sure that she's at zero in both branches of the superposition, but it's not something we do here. And it's something that, to me, is still open for debate whether you should do. Okay. So here is some other motivation. So nowadays, we also see a lot of papers on the notion of indefinite causal order. So indefinite causal order is this idea that, within quantum circuits, you can have quantum data that gets acted upon with our good usual quantum gates. But maybe we could be even more fancy and have not just the data that is quantum, but actually the circuit itself. Like, we could superpose quantum circuit layouts, and in particular superpose therefore the order of application of gates. And here I want to insist on the fact that if I apply this gate first and then this gate, you see that this first wire is able to send a signal to there, and this one is able to send a signal to there. So the first can talk to the third, but the third, it cannot talk to the first, right? There is no path to that. So this is a kind of space-time thing, because I see the whole layout of the circuit in time. But if I want to sort of project this in space, and I need to have some kind of a graph that tells me who is the neighbor of whom, an interaction graph. So in this picture here, the third node may send, the first node may send to the third. In this picture here, it's the third that may send to the first. So the point that I want to make is that somehow, whenever we speak about indefinite causal order, we are actually speaking about a kind of superposition of graphs, superpositions of discrete geometries. Another place where superpositions of graphs are to be found is in quantum gravity. And for instance, in loop quantum gravity, you would have these spin networks that evolve in a quantum mechanical manner in time. They wouldn't use unitary evolutions. They will use Feynman path integrals to do that. And in fact, they won't evolve the entire graph. They would tend to look at well encompassed portions of space-time. But nevertheless, it's the idea. I mean, there are graphs, and these guys evolve under quantum theory. And you get similar pictures in causal dynamical triangulations, in this whole family of theories of quantum gravity. Now, the point I want to make is that whether you are in the indefinite causal order community or the quantum gravity community, these superpositions of graphs, they are often very poorly defined, I mean, very quickly defined. And also, the notions of locality, causality, and even unitarity are often completely overlooked and poorly understood. So there is some work to be done here, and this is going to be my aim in the next slides. Okay. All right. So to introduce these superpositions of graphs, well, first of all, I need to revise a bit my Hilbert space, so that I now may have not just sets of nodes, but sets of nodes that may be connected to one another, so that I may have edges. Now, Actually, I've been trying to do that for a long time, and this gave me a hell of a lot of headache, and I got stuck on very basic questions. Very basic questions. If you want to do this, you run into very basic problems. So the one of the first difficulties I met is okay, so let's say that I want to use this tensor symbol here so that I'm able to speak about a certain part of a graph and the other parts of the graph. Because after all, I want these graphs to represent geometry, to represent places, and so my usual way to talk about that is through a tensor product. So I'd like to be able to do tensors of graphs. But then, okay, so this tensor here, what does it mean? Does it mean this graph where U and V are not connected, or does it mean that graph where U and V are connected? In other words, whenever you split a graph into two pieces, fine, but what do you do with the edges that would go across the symbol, right? The tensor symbol. Where is it gone? And how can you ever put a tensor symbol if there seems to be a third information that you need to put somewhere, right? Another big issue that I had is that in many first attempts, the reversibility of quantum mechanics, the reversibility or the unitarity, if you like, was actually forbidding me to create new nodes. For instance, I would have situations like this. Okay, I would say, this graph where there is a single node is going to evolve into a graph with two nodes. Okay, fine. So what name am I going to give to this node? I don't know. Let's call it V, or let's call it W. How do you choose between V and W? And if you take a random guy, well, by the way, you cannot be unitary at all. Okay, so let me tell you how you solve the first difficulty. So you solve it at a cost, which is to introduce a bit more structure in the names of the nodes. So I have this symbol here, which is called merge, say, and so you see here, my name has nothing to do with that name. They have nothing in common, and therefore I decide that these two are not connected. But here, this name, this node is called Y merge minus zeta, and this one is called zeta. And so I see that there is something in common, and it's that zeta. And therefore, I say, okay, then there is an edge. So basically, the names hold the geometry. The names hold the connectivity under these conventions. And then the difficulty one vanishes because this, when you put them together, this should be a Y, by the way. It's still a Y zeta, okay? And these two, when you put them together, well, you realize that there is a zeta in common, so there is an edge. Okay. Now, let's look about the second difficulty. And the second difficulty has a solution that is actually similar to the solution of the first difficulty. So the second difficulty is, let's say that I have a unitary evolution that takes a single node U into two nodes. Well, how do you want to call these two nodes? I don't know. Let's do it like in the internet. You know, yeah, I have a domain that has a certain IP address, and I want to create two subdomains. Well, you just append to the choose further numbers for you add dot blah and that creates a further subdomain, right? I forgot a bit about my network courses that I had in my bachelor. But the point is, it's more or less like that. So you could say name U goes to U.L and U.S. are. That's it. I've created two names out of my old name. Great. What about you, Dagger? You, Dagger, well, you know that, you know, you splits this guy. So these guys, they ought to be merged by you, Dagger. So what that says is that if I've got one white and one black node, you, Dagger, it ought to merge these two. Therefore, if this guy is called V and this guy is W, well, the merger, it should be called V merge W. And you see this merge symbol happening again. So now there is something that I can observe, however, is that what happens if I apply U-dagger here? Well, this resulting node is the merger of these two. So it's U.L merged with U.R. But at the same time, I know that I did U and U-dagger, so I should get back to U. Therefore, I'm obliged to conclude that u.l merge u.r is equal to u. Okay, this is saying I take a name, I take its left part, I merge it with its right part. Well, that's just the name. Okay. And similarly, I find that, you know, v and w, I merge them, I split them. Well, this thing here ought to be equal to this thing. So what does that mean? It means that the left part of a merger is, you know, is the left part of the merger, is the V. So suddenly you need, I mean, the input to this thing is very little. It's, I want dynamical graphs that are reversible, right? I want dynamical graphs that are reversible. And from just this need, you find that the names of the node, they need to have a little algebraic structure. You need to be able to compute a bit with the names. Just, you know, just like 3 + 1 = 4, natural numbers have an algebraic structure. Well, these names, they have a little bit of an algebraic structure. So, okay, so that's the thing, that's the cost that you have to the price to pay to have graphs. But once you've paid that price, then it's nice because all of the theorems I mentioned earlier on in the talk, all of these carry through to these quantum superpositions of graphs. Right. So, so in particular, you know, all of these results, they still hold true. So now you become able to speak about local operations that will actually alter the geometry of the graph. So for instance, here is a local operation that is going to take three nodes into two, right? It's going to make the graph smaller or bigger according to the appearance according to a pattern being there or not in the graph. But you can go even wilder, and you could say, you know, if there is this pattern, then I shrink my graph, or maybe I don't do anything in a superposition. And the rest, because I'm doing something local, the rest I'm not touching it. So you become able to talk about local operations that actually change the geometry of a graph. And it's not so untractable to the mind, really. I mean, at the end of the day, if you look at these definitions closely enough, you will realize that what they do is basically this. I mean, if you look at a single basic state, well, chi is going to select the part of it, and a chi local operator, what it does, it's just that it's replacing that disk with another disk, or maybe with a superposition of disks. So it's altering the graph at a precise place, possibly in a superposition. That's what these quantum local operations and graphs look like. Okay. And as as far as causality goes, well, all of the previous results, again, they still stand. You know, I could give you an example, but to construct an example, I need to do it step by step. So for instance, I could have a world of graphs with particles that move according to the move rule that I gave you before. And these particles, actually, they are walkers. So you would apply a coin that changes a bit their spin. And then you apply the H prime rule here that is going to shrink or expand the graph in a superposition. And so here you get quite a wild object that is causal, evolves an entire graph into superpositions of graphs, but in a way that respects causality. So I mean, just to emphasize this point, what we are talking about here is, you know, imagine Alice and Bob. They may be neighbors, or maybe they are not neighbors, and maybe they are in a superposition of being neighbors and not being neighbors, right? So what does it mean to be causal there? What does it mean to be causal when even the geometry is quantum? Okay, and what I'm saying is that here we have a proper mathematical way to talk about that and to handle this. Right. So actually, I'm almost finished. I will just summarize what I said. So I started with this idea that I want to make the notation for tensors more precise, and I want to say, oh, this is a tensor product between Alice and Bob and Charlie, or Alice, Bob and Charlie. Okay. And then, he took this idea further and start wondering, okay, but how far can we go at parametrizing tensors? They can be parametrized by any restriction, and entanglement is relative to that. And okay, but do these things really work? Do they really serve the purpose of tensors and traces? Well, they do, because all of the basic facts about locality and causality, whether you like the Schrödinger picture, whether you like an operational point of view upon quantum mechanics, or whether you like the Heisenberg picture, all of these properties still hold. And the way these properties are logically interrelated is safeguarded. In terms of applications, I mentioned this idea of being able to take the viewpoint of an observer, even if that observer is itself a quantum thing. And then I mentioned the need to look at quantum superpositions of graphs that you have arising in definite causal orders or in quantum gravity. The fact that, yeah, you need to formalize them, you need to be able to study unitarity, locality, causality. And basically, we have here a framework, a mathematical framework where all of these concepts are rigorous and work out well. So that's what I wanted to tell you about.
Thank you very much. Do we have questions for Pablo? Lucien.
Thanks for the talk. It's really, really interesting. I feel like I could spend a lot of time studying these ideas. It's very different from what I've seen before. So one thing I didn't fully understand, if you go back, I think just two slides, and you have the Schrodinger version of your causality. I think there are, so if interpreted in normal excuse me, normal quantum theory, this seems like it might be problematic. And so I think I have to understand your notation a bit more. On the left-hand side, you have the unitary operator and its dagger acting on the density matrix. And then on the right-hand side, you have that same, what looks like the same unitary operator acting on a reduced density matrix that might be associated with a different Hilbert space.
Yes,
and so that I was just trying to understand what that means.
Yes. So it's a fair question, and it's usually something that you need to fix if you are in your standard quantum mechanics. I agree. But here, it's just that I took a Hilbert space that is very large. It's the Hilbert space of all the graphs. So it's a Hilbert space that has the graphs with three nodes, but it also has the graphs with one node or with two nodes. So when I say that U is a unitary over that Hilbert space, that means it knows how to handle just one node or having three nodes. So if I take out nodes, it doesn't matter. U can still knows what to do.
But then in that case, is there any relationship between between U, the effective U at least, when it's acting on rho versus the effective U when it's acting on rho strictly? Because those would just be different, in the Hilbert space language, those would just be different elements on an orthogonal basis. And so the unitary operator could be doing entirely different things.
It could be doing entirely different things, but then it wouldn't be causal.
Okay, so the causality constraint is actually a constraint on unitaries from that point of view?
It's a property of the unitary.
Okay.
The unitary, perhaps I should have written here, U is chi zeta local if and only if one of these holds.
Okay. Okay, good. Sorry, I hadn't understood that. Okay, good. And then I had one other question, which I think may be related. So you have this issue of introducing these links, these edges.
Yes.
And you solve that by a naming convention.
Yes.
But then the physical meaning of those edges must presumably have some sort of dynamical meaning. Like earlier on, you'd mentioned how you introduced edges, even before you got to the naming convention, you introduced edges in terms of systems that could speak with one another.
Yes.
Those seem like the naming convention and the physical interpretation of edges seemed like two different, very different things. How do you couple them so that the naming convention actually ends up corresponding to the physical interpretation that they can talk to one another?
Okay. So, right. So, you see this chi and zeta, they can be quite arbitrary. They just need to be restrictions. And so, that allows for very different notions of causality. For instance, you could be in a context where your notion of causality is that only the black particles can talk to the black particles, for instance. So first of all, what I want to say is that this notion of causality is very abstract. It serves many, many purposes. Now, you could specialize it to the case where zeta is selecting just one node and chi is selecting that node and its neighbors. Now, what do you mean by "and its neighbors"? What you mean by "and its neighbors" is up to you. It's up to how do you define your restrictions. And in fact, I've played, here what I meant by "and its neighbors" was, well, zero is next to one and one is next to two. So I had a certain notion of a neighborhood in this example, which is actually different from the notion of neighborhood, which I later proposed here, right? So so at the end of the day, the answer to your question, to this later question, is the same as the answer to your previous question. What I mean is that it's a property of you. You may or may not be chi zeta local with respect to whatever you mean by chi and zeta. So if you are acting on stuff where you've decided that the edges, they are encoded in that manner, and you have a unitary operator, it may or may not verify the signaling constraint that is linked to this edge convention, right? And so that's it. You take a convention, it defines some geometry, and then your operator may or may not be compliant with that geometry, with that convention, right? With the geometry induced by the convention.
Okay, I think I get it. Thanks.
Next question is by TC.
Hi, Pablo. Thank you for the talk. It was very interesting. So I have two questions. My first question is considering what's on the slide right now, this idea of including some information in the names that encode the geometry. Mm-hmm. And when you first sort of proposed this conundrum and how you might resolve it, it seems to me that what this naming convention is taking care of is it's essentially just labeling sort of what hypothetical boundary condition there could be. And it feels like, and this might be just subjective, but it feels like a more natural thing to do would have your Hilbert space not be of graphs, but of open graphs, where you have potentially edges that aren't connected to anything. And maybe, you know, those edges are labeled, but that to me feels like what this names holds geometry is sort of doing. Is that correct? Or does this convention allow for something more intricate?
So, I mean, it's stuff that I've tried as well, these open graphs. In fact, mm-hmm. This corresponds to earlier tries. I'm not saying it's impossible to do that, but I think it may end up being more complicated.
Okay.
Now, you could still think of this node here as some kind of an open graph, that because it sort of knows about minus zeta. Okay, there is something else I should answer to that, which is that actually I don't care so much about name, right? I mean, names, they are just like some kind of a coordinate system that you sort of lay out on your node just to name them, right? So at the same time, I don't care about names, but at the same time, I give them an important role, which is to sometimes coincide and therefore induce a geometry. All right. So what I'm saying here is that in the paper, you will find a notion of renaming invariants, where you can actually, you know, rename all your stuff. And a notion of names that intersect. So for instance, these two names, they intersect on zeta. And so my point is that, for instance, here it looks like this guy is the open one because it knows about zeta, and this guy seems to be, not knowing anything, it's just called zeta. But up to renaming, it could look like it's the reverse way around. And the point is, it doesn't really matter what names they have. It's just names that intersect, right? So I'm saying that perhaps with open graphs, you may not have this such a neat renaming invariance. Maybe it will be, it will be harder to deal with.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. Thank you. I have another question, but I'll let everyone else go first.
Okay, then Rob, you can go.
Good. Well, so Pablo, first of all, that was a really clear presentation. So thanks for making it so clear. I have a few questions. So I don't know where to start. So one thing I wondered is that it seems to me that there might be a connection between this notion of tensor product, which is, so imagine you think of it as a way of picking out kind of a more general notion of a subsystem.
Mm-hmm.
So in quantum information theory, there is a more general notion of subsystem besides the thing that's associated with a factor of the total Hilbert space. So sometimes it goes by the name of virtual subsystems, for example. So you can have a factor space of a subspace. So you imagine like a direct sum structure. Every sector in that direct sum structure factorizes into components. And now I could just talk about one of the factors of one of the sectors. But furthermore, there's a notion of subsystem that can span many sectors. And the best way to think about it is just in terms of, if I think of the whole algebra of operators on the Hilbert space, whenever I pick out a subalgebra of that whole algebra and ask where does it act non-trivially, it can pick out some of these virtual subsystems in many sectors. So my subalgebra can pick that out. And so it seems to me when you went through your notion that it's conceivable that it's actually isomorphic to this notion of a subalgebra, the subsystem picked out by a subalgebra of the full operator algebra. I couldn't, see whether that was, it's in fact an isomorphism, but it seems like, something that might be worth looking into. So, have you thought about that?
I fully agree with you. And it's something that we've been thinking about with Augustin from Oxford, and we have an intern that will try and work that out in the next few months. Yes, I think it's a very, very good question, and it's in fact a fascinating question because it seems that in many situations in quantum mechanics there was already this issue that that somehow the tensor was too rough a way of speaking about subsystems, and you would rather talk about algebras, right? And commuting algebras, and so then you look at the structure of an algebra, and you've got this Wedderburn theorem that's telling you, I guess. So I didn't know this name, virtual subsystem. If you could have a reference for that particular way of calling it, but rather I would think of it in terms of the Wedderburn theorem that characterizes the shape of algebras. And we were wondering whether these chi's, they can actually single out, they can help re-express this Wedderburn theorem in a concise manner.
So I'm not familiar with the name of the theorem, but is it the theorem that says that every subalgebra of an algebra can be thought of as living on factor spaces? Like there exists a direct sum structure in the Hilbert space, exactly. and factorizations. Okay. I'll just mention this whole virtual subsystem idea. I mean, where it's useful in quantum information is that if I am doing error correction, for example, and I encode the qubit into a set of physical qubits, there's no single physical qubit where it's found. It's rather there's a virtual qubit, some part of the Hilbert space where that qubit is encoded. I can definitely send you a reference about that. Maybe I'll just mention that, like, that the one place where this appears already in textbook quantum mechanics is when you do angular momentum coupling. That if you ask where in the Hilbert space are the kind of non-trivial representations of the rotation group, typically that's, you can't find any individual spin. There's some funny virtual subsystem inside the Hilbert space. So that's, yet another example where this sort of more general notion of subsystem would come up. All right, let me just, there's one other question I had that was connected to it. I'll leave the others away for now so that other people can ask questions. But when we talked about potential applications, you mentioned the quantum reference frame stuff where you take the viewpoint of one particle. So another one that seems to me, I mean, you can certainly do it from this algebraic perspective, and maybe it'd be useful to do it from your perspective, is the transition from first quantized formulation to second quantized formulation. So say I'm just talking about two bosons. So if in first quantized notation, I'd say, all right, there's boson one, boson two, and you know, if they can only take each of two possible states, let's call them left and right, then I could have, you know, left tensor left, right tensor right, or left right plus right left. So now if I do something like what you did and said, okay, well, let me try to find a new tensor product where the right stuff is on the left of the tensor product, and sorry, the left stuff is on the left of the tensor product and the right stuff is on the right of the tensor product. Then what you're going to be looking at would be something like, you have to keep track of how many rights, how many left there are. So your left tensor S would become like two tensor zero, because there's two things that are left and zero that are right. And your right tensor right would become zero tensor two. And your left tensor right plus right tensor left would just become left tensor, one tensor one. You know, there's one excitation in the left, one excitation in the right. So anyways, that kind of switch from a tensor product with respect to particles, you know, particle one, particle two, to a tensor product with respect to modes, the left mode and the right mode, strikes me as very similar to your chi map, except that it adds this extra complication of counting how many things of that state you have.
Okay. So thanks. I mean, I think I agree with you. I think it was difficult for me to visualize the concrete examples that you gave, but I think I'm on the same same wave anyway. Same. Yes. Yeah. Maybe. Hey. Maybe it'd be good to discuss this later, perhaps, so you should just show me what you mean precisely.
Okay. So I have another question, but I'll leave it. I'll send it back to TC and anybody else for now. Thanks.
Well, so there's also a question by Ellie. Yeah, maybe you can go, and then there's the second round.
Sure. Thanks. So yes, definitely. Thank you for the talk. My question is, are graphs sort of sufficient to answer the questions that are motivating this work? So you mentioned the indefinite causal structure and the states that you have there for like whether one talks to three or three talks to one. They were not just graphs. They were sort of mixed graph, which had directed and undirected edges. And I'm wondering whether sort of you would say, like, is your naming convention rich enough to talk about like things which can talk to each other but can only talk one way? And sort of the follow-up to that would be this paper by Robin Lorenz and John Barrett about like causal and compositional structure of unitaries, where it somewhat generalizes this idea, and you can have lots of different ways that one layer can sort of talk to the next layer. And it's inadequate to sort of express that using the language of graphs, but they do manage to express it quite nicely in the language of hypergraphs. And I'm wondering whether like that's also something that you'd be able to sort of come up with a naming convention where the rules would then apply.
So for the first question, this naming convention here, you see that there is a minus zeta and a zeta. So you could use it to induce directed graphs instead. And then it means that when you will demand causality, you need to demand that zeta, the one single node, be fully determined by zeta r, but r now be an oriented neighborhood. And so you can very well do that. Mathematically, there is no problem. It's there. It's there. The paper is flexible enough so that you can do this at the mathematical level. So then your question, the second part of your question, it was about, so John Barrett did two things, and I'm wondering, he did many things, but I'm wondering whether you're speaking about rooted quantum circuits that he did with Van Velde, Augustin, or more like the causation, the common cause stuff, the quantum common cause stuff.
So I think you've actually answered my question with talking about directed neighborhoods. I think that does tell me that you can handle it. But in the chat, if I can do this, the paper that I was referring to is this one.
So, okay, so I'm not sure I see the chat. Let me
see. It's called Causal and Compositional Structure of Unitary Transformations.
Okay, so I'm not sure I'm aware of that. No, sorry.
It seems to me like if you can handle neighborhoods of any kind of direction, it's going to be fine. Thank you.
So, TC, did you still have a question?
Yeah, I sort of do. I've been thinking about it more, and I'm starting to realize it's not that interesting of a question. But I'll just ask it anyway. So you mentioned before how, you know, there are a couple different approaches to quantum gravity where you encounter this kind of question of like dynamics on graphs. And in particular, I'm thinking about, you mentioned like the spin foam part of loop quantum gravity. And when I think about like how those are built, there's already like, you know, Hilbert space structure all over the graphs themselves. Like the edges are themselves vector spaces and the nodes are like operators on those spaces such that, you know, the overall thing can be just an amplitude. But it seems like what you're doing here is equipping the spaces of these graphs with an additional Hilbert space structure. Is that the right way of conceptualizing what's happening here? And in particular, if that's the case, like, when you think about like spin foams, for example, there are all these like algebraic identities that come from certain sums over graphs are equal to other sums over other graphs, right? There are these just like linear identities on, you know, the different sums over graphs. And I'm wondering if you've considered that as part of the formalism, like how do you impose that, you know, the superposition of these two graphs is the same as a single graph. Anyway, thanks.
Okay. So first of all, I think we must be careful to distinguish between spin networks and spin foams, right? So this would be more akin to spin networks. And because spin foams, they describe one history of an evolution of a spin network, right? In a sum, and then you would do a sum over path over the different amplitudes of each spin foams to finally work out how you transition from a spin network to another or yeah. Okay. So all I can say here is that so the spin networks, they have a very particular shape. There is some representation of you know, some intertwiners that that color the nodes and some okay, all of this here is left for the user to choose. I mean, you could put some colors on the edges if you wanted to. You can put whatever intertwiners in the nodes. It's not a problem, but there is no bias towards any particular choice. And in particular, there are, you know, plenty of arguments why you can some degrees of freedom, maybe gauge or whatever, which, you know, that are not at all addressed in this paper. So whatever redundancies you may have in those choices of coloring your graphs, I'm not the right person to discuss at this stage. Yeah.
Thank you. No, that answered my question. In some sense, like what you've been talking about here is something independent of those considerations. It's an extra tool on top of any of this stuff.
It's more a general mathematical framework because, for instance, in those theories, you will often, you know, people will mention these graphs with all of these intertwiners you put on top, etc. But actually, it's not even clear when you look at these papers that that the nodes are named or not. And that term, that can be quite crucial. So in some other paper with Amelia Derbeck and Marius Christodoulou, we kind of showed that if your nodes are not named, then you can get effects like signaling at a distance, like superluminal signaling. And so that's not something you would want to consider. So my point is, it's more like taking a step back and trying to provide a mathematical framework where you can start speaking about these things rigorously.
Thank you.
But some things here are open for debate. For instance, this idea of having names to align the nodes. If I speak to Carlo Rovelli, he's very enthusiastic about it. But when I speak with the CDT community, for instance, they were very displeased with the idea, and they believe that everything should be DFAO invariant before taking superposition, whereas we are saying that it should be DFAO invariant after taking the superposition. So anyway, it's still, you know, this debate has to take place.
Do we have more questions?
I have a follow-up question if we have time. And it's actually, I think, concerning this slide. So I guess it's a proposal for a solution to this problem, which I think is equivalent to your solution, might be different, but it seems to me like it's equivalent, but maybe a slightly different way of thinking about it. So you start out by saying, all right, we're gonna have an orthonormal basis labeled by graphs. And so like, you know, in the case, the simple case where you have, say, no edges in the graph, it's just the different colorings of the nodes. So if every node can be black or white, and let's say I have four nodes, then you know, I have 2^4 elements in that basis. But now if I start allowing, you know, edges, well, for, you know, every pair of nodes, I could have no edge or an edge. So now, and there's, you know, 6 pairs of nodes. So I have 2^6 possibilities for how to connect them up. So there's 2^10 graphs in all, you know, that they have colored nodes and they either have edges or not. So the comment is like, if you think of the edges as just another thing that takes a value, and you know, it could be more than two values. Like there are graphs that have two kinds of edges. So, you know, or three kinds, you know, no edge, edge, dashed edge. You know, that's just like allowing white, black, or gray for colors for your nodes. So then you could just define your mu maps as partitions, not only among the nodes, but among the edges as well. So like one mu map could be, all right, take the edge between Y and Z and lump it together with Y, you know, like, and then the other one could be, you know, take that edge and lump it together with Z. And furthermore, there could be, you know, maps that stipulate that you should add in an edge that has its sort of trivial value of no edge, and another one that stipulates you should add in one that is a connected edge. Or so, yeah, I guess my question is, have you thought about doing it that way? And is it equivalent to what you're describing here?
So, so first of all, yes, I thought about doing it at least in similar ways, because this reminds me a lot of the quantum graffiti papers that were done by Fotini Markopoulou in PI, for instance, where she would consider Hamiltonians over graphs, where you'd have qubits that say whether an edge is active. So she takes a complete graph, and then she puts qubits to say whether the edge is active or not, and she's looking at Hamiltonians that respect these constraints. Then I had this kind of issue. Yeah, okay, but where do I place the thing? Do I place it left or right? But in a sense, I think you're right. Maybe we could leave that for the tensor to decide whether right. It should be left or right. That perhaps is not something that I had in mind, and it's a good remark.
In the example you have here on the screen, the top mu, you know, you could rewrite the left-hand side as the white Y node and the kind of trivial edge, no edge, tensor with Z. And then below it, you have the white Y node and the non-trivial edge tensored with Z. You know, like that, those are your two mu's. So it's just sort of what's on the left has a different value for the edge between Y and Z.
Yes. No, I think that that could work. There is also something we've explored in a recent paper called addressable quantum gates. So it's yet another solution, I think, which is the idea that. So can I draw stuff here? Wait. It's just the idea that, so for instance, you have a CNOT gate, and maybe it's called gate 4, and then some wire goes to a Hadamard gate, and this Hadamard gate is called gate 5. So we would encode that by saying the CNOT gate knows the address of the next gate, the Hadamard gate. So it knows that it should send its wire towards 5. But now, because you soft code the wiring, you could actually superpose wirings. You could say, okay, now maybe the CNOT is not going to send this wire to gate 5, but to gate 7, or to gate 5 plus 7. And so in this view, you have nodes that hold addresses of other nodes, and this can be dynamical and superposed. I think that's not quite what you're saying, but it's yet another possible alternative. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, that is a bit different. I was just more sort of trying to code the connections of a graph in terms of, for every potential connection, you just stipulate whether it's off or on. So it's still a bunch of binary degrees of freedom that are exponential in number, rather than stipulating addresses of things you're connected to.
Just to come back on what you said at the very beginning of your question, there is, for two nodes, there is even more degrees of freedom in a sense, because there is all the naming choices that you could have used. You could have called this sure. Y or X or 1,000. And so even for one node, it's already infinite, the numbers of degrees of freedom, in the sense that in the Hilbert space, if two nodes are named differently, they are orthogonal.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this kind of degree of freedom you don't like, and you want your observables and your unitary evolutions to commute with renaming. And so it's not really something you can use for storage, but it's there.
That's interesting. I realize now, given everything you said, that given that you don't demand that all your graphs have the same number of nodes, right? Like you considered inner products of, graphs with two nodes, graphs with one node. I guess the way I would try to encode that in the scheme I just described would be something like you have a just like you have a trivial notion of edge, like no edge present as a, you know, value for that edge, you could have a sort of trivial value for each node. You know, this node is not present. So the node could be not present, white, black, gray, whatever. Those are just, you know, all the values of that node. So now every graph would have sort of a placeholder for every type of node, placeholder for every edge, and the graph with just one node just happens to be trivial everywhere else. And it feels like you could do it that way, and you'd have the same expressive power as what you were describing.
Yes, only this notation seems a bit sparser.
I guess I wasn't suggesting any change of notation, but maybe just a...
interpretation.
A change of how to think about it, but also, I guess, on this slide, a different way of thinking about how to define these multiple mu's. It would be one that stipulated an edge degree of freedom as something that can enter into this tensor product notion. You know, it can be on the left, it can be on the right, the edge can take different values. Anyways, but thanks for that. That answers my question.
Okay, so we've already done more than 30 minutes of questions. So I guess we should just thank the speaker again. Was a very interesting talk, and have a good weekend, everybody.
Okay, thanks a lot for the invitation, and maybe